Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hi, I'm Ravi Agrawal. This is Global Reboot. Welcome to the show. On last week's episode, we talked about the growing importance of the Global South. I want to build on that this week. Part of the reason the countries of the so-called Global South are becoming more powerful is that many of their economies are growing rapidly, such as India, Indonesia, or Saudi Arabia. But there's also another set of factors. These countries recognize that America's relative power is declining. They see that the era of American primacy as the world's only superpower is either already over or getting there. China is not ready to take on that mantle. So we're in this new, messy era where no one nation has the power to back the global system. And that means multilateralism itself is facing a challenge it hasn't faced in decades. All of this sounds really wonky, I know, so let me put it more simply. Who runs the world? If it's not one country, then is it an organization? Well, the UN is gridlocked. We all know that. It can't agree on big issues such as dealing with the wars in Ukraine or Gaza. The IMF and the World Bank, well, they're seen as Western institutions dealing mostly with problems in the global south, and it's not working out. So the question then is multilateralism broken? I put that question to Borga Brenda, the president of the World Economic Forum and a former foreign minister of Norway. I usually run into Borga either at Davos in Switzerland, where the World Economic Forum's annual meeting is held, or in New York. This time, we met up in Doha, in Qatar, on the sidelines of the Doha Forum, where questions about the world order were hot topics of discussion. Global Reboot is a partnership between foreign policy and the Doha Forum. This is episode 8 of season 3, our final episode this year. Let's dive in. Borga Brenda, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So everyone says multilateralism is broken. Is it?
It's not in its finest moment, that's for sure. Intergovernmental processes are very difficult. We see that now during COP28. We also know that at the heart of multilateralism, intergovernmental processes, is the Security Council at the UN, and the mood there is quite toxic. Even during the Cold War, there was areas where they could agree on resolutions. Today, it is a lot tougher. The challenge, though, with multilateralism being under so much pressure is that more and more of the great challenges of our time do travel without passport. Climate change, pandemics, cyber attacks, also AI has a huge impact on all of us. And if we're going to set standards and going to make sure that we work in the interests of humankind, we need to deal with those challenges at the right level. That's the global level. The only way to, for example, put out rules for artificial intelligence is that we agree on some common traffic rules. And we're not close to that.
But what's changed here? Because was there a time 20, 30 years ago when multilateralism was working better than it is now? And if that's the case, what's changed?
I think it was, of course, easier just the decade after the Cold War. Then you were more in a unipolar world. You had the U.S. as kind of a sole superpower. It's still a superpower, the U.S., but maybe a superpower without superpowers. That's what we're seeing. But that period was a period where we had the Rio Summit in 1992, where we got the first new agreements on climate change, biodiversity. Countries came together. We saw a World Trade Organization being created. We saw doubling of global trade, tariffs being reduced, like a win-win approach to things. China joined the WTO in 2001 here in Doha.
That's right.
So that was incredible moments for a win-win thinking. So no, I think we moved, if you use the trade context, I think we moved into like a beggar thy neighbor approach,
yes,
instead of prosper your neighbor approach. And I think the challenge is that we will, for example, have no real economic recovery now without recovery also in collaboration, in trade, and in investments. And it doesn't look likely very soon.
That's right. You use the phrase win-win, but another phrase often gets deployed a lot these days, and that's winners and losers. And globalization, for example, created winners and losers. There were winners and losers from the pandemic in terms of countries that got vaccines quickly and other countries that struggled to get them as quickly. There are winners and losers in the world of multilateralism in terms of whose voice gets heard at places like the UN, for example. Some of this, as you've pointed out, has to do with the relative change in power of the United States as former sole superpower to now just a superpower. But what else? What other things have led to this moment where there seems to be growing distrust in the global order, as it were, in the rules-based liberal international order in the multilateral system?
So definitely we are between orders. We had one order, as you said. It was a more of a liberal, rules-based world order. But we don't know what the new order will be. Hopefully not a jungle growing back, but also with rules and also level playing fields and collaboration. But it will be a different cooperation than we have seen in the past. But when you are between orders, it also means that there is competition, there is unpredictability, and we have seen that also past in the history. Well, in Europe, we have tried multipolarity. We had multipolarity in the 19th century, but without multilateralism.
That's
right. Without any rules.
That's
and
right.
And we saw how that ended.
Right.
Not very well. So multipolarity is potentially a positive thing for the world moving forward, with the big caveat that we also need multilateralism on top of it, where we agree on some rules. Just imagine like New York or Delhi without traffic rules. You know, it would be total chaos. So I think also globalism has had a rough time lately in the media and also in the global discourse, but we should not lose the baby with the bathwater in the context of what has happened during the 30 last years. Since 1990, we doubled the global GDP. The driving force for that was trade, increased four times. And in 1990, we had 40% of the global population living in extreme poverty. Today, it's 10%. So globalism, of course, creates challenges, but we cannot neglect or deny the positive yields from this. For example, on the extreme poverty is also even more striking, because in 1990, we had 5 billion people on our planet. Today, we are 7-8.
Yep.
And then moving from 40% to 10%. So this win-win thinking and using your comparative advantages and buying where it's cheapest also created a lot of growth and prosperity. We maybe went too far, but so we have to adjust it.
Right.
But I don't think we should
throw
give
the baby out with
globalism all. It's now being like blamed for everything that is not good in the world, even if it has been a driving force for a lot of progress.
Yeah. One of the things the pandemic did is it kind of instigated a real fear in supply chains. So as the story goes, in early 2020, when America suddenly realized it needed a lot of masks, and it realized that most of the masks were made by China, it really changed the mood in the United States, where there was this rising fear of globalization, a rising fear of supply chains. And in many senses, American foreign policy since then has been transformed. There's a real appreciation for economics through national security, a foreign policy for the middle class, for example, as the Biden White House often says. And that sense of mistrust of globalization and of supply chains, which has led to a movement towards nearshoring, friendshoring, ally shoring, whatever you want to call it, is something that many countries share in Europe, India as well, China in its own way. This makes it much harder for smaller countries to compete because they can't avail of the same facilities that they did in a much more globalized world without protectionism. But let me ask you about America's role in all of this. Do you think America is to blame for some of this change in mood globally? Some of this is about protectionism. America is often accused of being protectionist. Some of it also more recently, and now I'm thinking about the wars in Gaza and Ukraine, is an accusation from much of the countries of the global south that America has double standards or hypocrisy. And that too hurts a sense of multilateralism and who really upholds the global order.
I think some of the nearshoring and de-risking makes sense for countries. I think if you get most of the antibiotics in the world produced one place, or you have all the semiconductors almost produced in one country, critical minerals just one place, I think
that's risky.
Yeah, it's not common sense to do that. So to be more conscious about this and not only have value chains just in time, but also just in case, important. But what we need to know is also if you go for too far there and start to friendshore, you have to define who are your friends.
That's right.
And for America, as the largest economy in the world, is Nigeria a friend? Is South Africa a friend? India is definitely defined as a friend now. It's also
then there's the question of, do you define friends by interests or values?
Yeah. So that's also a very good comment. Let me come back to that, because that is when it gets really, really complicated. But what we need to be aware of is that the inflationary pressure that we have seen, the highest inflation now in decades, part of that is also related to the fact that the value chains are being rethought. And then the input factors, the things that we import, gets more expensive because you're not buying it necessarily where it's cheapest anymore, but where you think it can also de-risk.
Yeah.
So this is putting pressure on the prices. And in addition, we're going through an energy transition that we haven't seen in 200 years. We built the whole industrial revolution on carbon. And now we want to build a prosperous future without carbon, decarbonization, something that makes sense. But it will, of course, take a bit of time. But generally, the price of inaction so far exceeds the price of action. But it will drive up the price of energy and electricity in the years to come. So those two factors will push inflation up. So we will not go anytime soon back in a situation where we will have low inflation. Hopefully, in a couple of years, we can meet the inflationary target so interest rates can go down. So then the role of America. And I can understand that you put that on the table. The American economics are good. America came through COVID and got a recovery that is stronger than most of the other big economies. This year, we're seeing $8 trillion added to the global economy, from $100 trillion to $108. And 45% of that growth comes from one single country, being the United States of America. Right. So it's doing well economically. The political situation in the US is extremely polarized and extremely unpredictable. But America is still a big force. 25% of the global economy, 5% of the global population, and close to 50% of the global military force. So what happens in America means a lot to the rest of the world. Then it is your question about the standing of the U.S. U.S. has been through a lot of turbulence. They had the Trump presidency, a big discussion about the election result, a Biden administration that had also a tough start with Afghanistan pullout, but has now also launched this new concept of modern supply-side economics. And it seems like it's working pretty well, but it doesn't get a lot of credit for it, neither in the U.S. or abroad. And the latest, of course, geopolitical situation with U.S. being isolated in the Security Council is also a big challenge for the U.S. In the way a lot of countries look at them. But, you know, U.S. is a democracy. A lot of the countries criticizing U.S. now are non-democracies.
That's right.
And they have different standards. So there is a lot to think about in that context too.
So as we think about fixing multilateralism or improving it or rebooting it, what are the things you think the world needs to keep in mind? And I guess crucially, and related to our previous parts of this discussion, what role will America play in such a revitalization of multilateralism?
First, I think we need to see the election in the U.S. next year. I think the Biden administration are, in principle, believers in multilateralism and also the UN. But of course, if you're a superpower, you decide a lot. So you don't want to delegate too much to the multilateral channels either.
True.
That's always been a dilemma, even for democratic administrations in the U.S.
True.
A second Trump presidency, I think, will put less emphasis on the UN and multilateralism. We saw that also in the first Trump presidency. That's more unilateralism and America first policies. So I think that's going to be very interesting to follow.
So given how unpredictable 2024 is going to be on that front, let's park the America question aside for a minute. Imagine you have an America that does want to engage with the world. How then do you go about boosting multilateralism and reversing some of the trends we've been discussing for the last 20 minutes?
So I think that there will be maybe more of an ad hoc approach to multilateralism and intergovernmental processes, but also maybe more coalition building in the future. So we have seen, for example, on the trade side that plurilateral deals are now quite in demand. There will like be then 80 countries coming together that wants to create framework for e-commerce, or 100 countries coming together. And even if you cannot get the agreement through the World Trade Organization, they can use the WTO framework to agree on a plurilateral agreement, for example, then on services or digital trade. I can see this also in other areas moving forward, on climate, also, for example, on AI regulations. EU came out now with a very interesting framework for AI, and they could put it out on the market and say, who wants to join this? And then you can have coalitions being built there. I just think that it's harder to see the big countries of the world, the G7, the BRICS, and etc., being as willing as in the past to negotiate for months, and then one single country then can stop the whole process. I think that's not going to be the case. Then you have the legitimacy also of the Bretton Woods institutions, where they were created For different challenges after
1945. This is the World Bank and the IMF and others.
Yeah, and the WTO. And then they were built at a different time with different challenges, and their representation there is still tilted towards the West. That's why you have the BRICS Bank, the Belt and Road Bank, and et cetera, appearing.
Mm. You wrote an essay recently in which you used the word co-opetition, which is a portmanteau of cooperation and competition. And this is actually a word that's, I think, emerged out of game theory and the business world about how companies can compete and cooperate at the same time. And you used it to describe geopolitics today and the importance of countries doing the same. How do you think that works out? And is that happening more than people realize? Because I think people tend to see big divisions at places like the United Nations, but what they often don't see is the kind of cooperation you've been describing and that you do through the World Economic Forum or at Doha Forum, where we're sitting right now.
It's true, a more kind of media-friendly way of saying it is we have a lot of frenemies out there.
Right.
So I think between the U.S. and China being 45% of the global economy, it means a lot when President Biden and President Xi Jinping can meet, even if they don't see eye to eye on all these issues. They can have long discussions dealing with things ad hoc. Can they, for example, agree on some guidelines on AI? What can they agree on climate change? Can we triple, for example, the amount of renewables by 2030? Can we have a total ban on methane by 2030? And then you can go on and on. And it ended also in agreeing on having a hotline. So if there is a misunderstanding approaching on the military side, before they didn't even know who to call. And now they can pick up like this red phone that we used to have between Kremlin and Washington DC during the Cold War. So this, I think, realistically, is the way moving forward. And you will see more regional trade agreements too. And you will see trade agreements between countries and alliances that feel that they have much more in common. And you will see also checks and balances being developed. And you will see a little bit like the Cold War, that big nations try to court smaller nations to get them on their side.
Mm. And we're seeing that now with so-called middle countries or swing states, as they're known.
Yeah. And so we saw that now with the elections in the Maldives,
right,
where there was a lot at stake, and one party was seen as more pro-India and another one more pro-China. I think it's more complex than that, but election results ended with also India being asked to have their marine navy leave the islands, even if, well, of course, India would say it's rescue vessels. But they're not inviting China, though. They're saying that we don't want on our territory any of the big nations being represented. But this is just the tip of the iceberg. Look at Asia. Myanmar is where India and China meets. Yeah. Bangladesh, Nepal is also where India and China meets. So it's not only the U.S. and China. There is also other countries. And unfortunately, we are also seeing more proxy situations where it's not in the interests of the countries and the civilians. In Africa, I'm very worried, being the new kind of theater for proxy wars. I would say Sudan, partly Ethiopia, partly Somalia. And I can mention also other countries in West Africa and the Francophone Africa that is not looking good. Mm. So there is not conflicts among the big powers directly.
Mm.
That one tries to avoid, but you can use your proxies.
So I guess this brings us back to multilateralism, right? Because what is the role of a big multilateral organization like the UN in a big global conflict, because, you know, ultimately, if you have a pandemic or a giant asteroid hits the Earth, you need something that goes much beyond two strong countries or bilateral or regional solutions. And you've described some of this through sectoral issues that the world can come together and agree on. But in terms of bigger issues that arise, such as another pandemic, what do you think is the best way for the world to get together? And is it still the UN?
We can see all the faults with the UN, but it's the best alternative we have. It's all the countries of the world, even in such a quite toxic global geopolitical situation. The ambassadors do meet, and also ministers in the UN context. They might use strong language against each other. Sometimes they even shout, but not as frequently as during the Cold War.
That's right.
But that is also reflecting the reality. So when you see this being displayed in the Security Council, it is really where we are. But it's good that we have those institutions. And those institutions are also ready, as you say. If there is another new, more serious pandemic on the horizon, that's, for example, where you could see children being more affected, as we have seen in the past, then there's no other way than using those institutions. And maybe they will shout less and then collaborate out of necessity. I wish that was also the case for climate change. It is a bit crazy that we are seeing now huge cost of climate change, but still there's used more money on subsidizing fossil fuel, including coal, in the world, using taxpayers' money to make it cheaper than it's used on subsidizing the introduction of renewables. So you can say that the glass is, I don't want to be too pessimistic either, because the glass is half empty or half full. I would say it's half full, because also if we met 10 years ago and I said that the price of solar would fall to 1/10, you probably would say you're really a naive person. But today, wind and solar is competitive with all other energy sources without any kind of subsidies and are the cheapest ones. But it's not moving fast enough.
You know, when someone says something optimistic, I always find that it's a good moment to end an interview. So, Børge Brende, thank you so much for joining me.
No, thank you so much for inviting me. I enjoyed our discussion.
Me too. And that was Børge Brende, the president of the World Economic Forum and also the former foreign minister of Norway. Global Reboot is a partnership between Foreign Policy and the Doha Forum. Our production staff includes Rosie Julin and Olatunji Osho Williams. That is it for Season 3 of Global Reboot. It's been a pleasure. I'm Ravi Agrawal. Thanks for listening.